Welcome to Zeke Talk. My name is Jim Tudor, and it is the very first day of June. I am here with my special guest co-host, Michael Anderson.
Hello, I'm Michael Anderson, filmmaker and hipster in training. And with me is my wife, Jim.
Hey, I'm Jen Anderson, a freelance writer, a college film critic way back in the day, and pop culture junkie.
Absolutely. It's fantastic to have you here, Jen. So you guys both met in a little bit of a funny way, I guess. You want to tell us about that for a second?
Oh, sure. I mean,
not to put you on the spot.
You know, the early days of internet dating, and what really stood out to her was that Jen here was a big Blake 7 fan. And
he was a Doctor Who fan.
That's right.
And he was able to explain to me what Doctor Who was, because I'd never been able to get into it, because I didn't know that he was a time-traveling alien, and that's all you need to tell me.
But this, of course, was the pre-modern Doctor Who series days. This was back when, you know, it was just the old BBC series, the special effects budget of 20 pounds and a sixpence. So
there was nothing cool about Doctor Who at all yet.
No, because coolness was a circle. It was so uncool that to those of us that loved it, it was the coolest thing ever.
Yes, I felt left out of geek culture a little bit because I was not down with the Who.
That's right, but I did my best to try to remedy that, and we spent our second date watching Talons of Wang Chiang holding hands.
That's right, holding hands, and because it's a very dark, dimly lit episode, very very moody, we just sat there seeing our reflections as we're holding hands. It's very
That's funny.
Yes, it was.
So, and what is this? The Talons, it's a classic episode of Doctor Who. See, I'm less versed on this than you are, Jen. I don't even know.
Oh, well, you know. I'm the expert now. I mean, come on. I'm married to one of the co-founders of DWNY.
Yes.
You know? I was made to watch the now classic modern episode of the Stone Angels.
The Weeping Angels.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. That was very good.
Yes. Don't blink.
So I get all those references. That's it. That's it. I don't know anything else. I did see Blake 7 back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, that's just to give our audience here a point of reference of where you guys are coming from as fans.
Yes.
Of things. Various things.
Yes, because we are fans of various things.
Yes.
So I've discovered over the years.
Many various things, yes.
Aren't we all? Okay, well, let's move on then. There's some new films opening in the theaters that we'll acknowledge. We won't spend a whole lot of time on. We're going to talk about Wonder Woman next week after everybody's had a chance to see it. I saw it on Tuesday, so I won't talk about it yet, but that's coming. I ought to have a review up at the website, up at the ZekeFilm.org website tonight, although I have not written one word of it yet.
Okay. Can you give us a preview? What's the first word?
Oh, probably you're a Wonder Woman.
Okay.
That's way more than one word. No, I don't know. I don't know, Mike. I don't know. It's still forming in my head. What I'm hoping is that Max Foisy, who is a radio host here in St. Louis, who also contributes to the site, I'm hoping he comes through with his Wonder Woman review, because he is an enormous Wonder Woman fan, like for real. When I used to work at the comic book store here in St. Louis, Max would come in as a customer and buy tons of Wonder Woman comics and even, you know, those like $200 porcelain statues and things like that. He always had his eye on those as well. I'm not going to say he bought them in case his wife is watching. But yes, they you know, he's the real thing. And he was at the screening as well. And afterwards, he said he was going to write something for the site about the Wonder Woman movie. And it was going to be long. And he wouldn't tell me his opinion.
Well, so, okay. Well, I look forward to reading that.
If that's sure not a tease, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
I'm sure it will be a well-informed opinion.
Yeah, maybe too well-informed. But we'll find out. The review I did get to write is the other big superhero movie opening this weekend, Captain Underpants.
Ooh. Ooh.
The epic first movie.
I would love to hear what Captain Underpants is like.
Well, have you ever heard of Captain Underpants, the books?
Yes, I have heard about Captain Underpants, yes.
Oh, so you see, I didn't even know. This is about a 20-year-old property, and there's been, I guess, depending on how you count it, between 12 and 15 books. And I didn't know anything about it other than it existed. It's like I would walk through the Barnes & Noble kids section with my kids and see a Captain Underpants book cover, and that was about the extent of it. So when they announced this movie, was going to be screening for critics, I thought, well, this is good. I can take my six-year-old son to it. That sounds, you know, at a glance, it's a guy in underpants and a towel who is a superhero. And I thought, that sounds like right in the wheelhouse of a six-year-old boy.
Yes, so it does. Say no more.
Yes. I told my other kids then, who are older, that I would take him only because, you know, I try to take each of them to one movie as a date, you know, like, and like I'll pick something that, you know, it's always a critic screening, so I don't have to pay. So we did Kong Skull Island with my 11-year-old and Beauty and the Beast with our, you know, 8-year-old daughter. And now, Underpants, Captain Underpants for the 6-year-old. And I said, we're going to do Captain Underpants with just him. And the other two older ones were like, no, I wanted to see that. They were genuinely disappointed.
And what did the six-year-old think?
I know. Well, he really loved it. My take on it is that it's fun, but it's also one of these hyper-frenetic animated kids movies. And it's smart, but it's also just top-to-bottom bathroom humor, but very clean bathroom humor, you know? It's a lot of talk about poop and everything, but you never see any poop. It's that kind of deal. So, you know, by the end, there's a giant Godzilla-sized mechanical toilet rampaging through the city. And the kids are just dying. They love this movie. But it's a superhero spoof. And, you know, you guys know The Tick and all these other superhero spoofs that have been around for so long. The notion of a superhero spoof is, I think, kind of really old hat, you know? And so
I get what you're saying, but we have so many new superhero movies out that we still need to tweak the genre.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, now more than ever, I think, you know, there needs to be some sort of humorous tweaking of the superhero, especially as the superhero movies have gotten more ponderous and self-important.
I agree. And that's why I think the way they do this spoof is antiquated. If you're going to do a spoof, I agree with you that it should be the spoof of what we're getting a barrage of now. What Captain Underpants is doing is that thing where the superhero steps up and, you know, fear not, citizen, and he does his theme song, tra-la-la, you know, and then he jumps into action. And it's that kind of thing. It's the, what they're spoofing is like the Bud Collier Superman radio dramas, you know, and it's like, of course, the six-year-olds aren't going to put that together. Their parents aren't even going to put that together.
But it's so old, it must seem fresh to them.
I think it's so old that it seems like completely arbitrary and out of left field to them. And therefore, it's hilarious.
Yes.
I don't know. But, then, you know, I enjoyed the movie. You know, I did have to, like, get up and leave about an hour in, which is sometimes the case with these hyper-frenetic kids' movies. I'm stepping out for a minute. I don't care. And, that happened here. You know, just kind of get my bearings. It's, you know, they're just too loud. And too bright, all of that. But that said, the jokes are funny. So Captain Underpants, the epic first movie, sounds like a promise that they're going to make more.
Cool.
Yeah. What else is out? I don't know that there's a whole lot else new. We've got some reviews of a film about Winston Churchill. We've got a review on this website by Eric Yates about Winston Churchill called Churchill. That's coming out. I don't really know. The Pirates of the Caribbean 5, I believe, has opened, and I don't know how that's doing at the box office. That's been out for a week now.
Yeah.
Any interest?
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, no interest in actually seeing it, but but to talk about the Pirates of the Caribbean and the way that the blockbuster series has sort of stumbled and zombified.
Yeah,
I think that there's definitely been diminishing returns. It was very fresh, and no one would have expected a movie based on a Disney amusement park ride was going to be good.
No.
And even with the low expectations, it was just spectacular. Even, you know, so it was just a revelation. And then they kept trying to repeat that, and you just can't. And they just failed more and more as they continue.
Yes. That's the thing, is that it's sort of the slow trajectory of Johnny Depp. From he's sort of taking the Nicolas Cage path of stardom, where it's like the quirky actor who, for a while there, you know, I remember Nicolas Cage when he was first on the scene. I was excited to see what Nicolas Cage would be doing next, because he was fearless. He would go out there. Even if what he was doing wasn't necessarily right for the part, I'm looking at you, Piggy Sue Got Married. You know, he was interesting. He was trying something. And soon that sort of developed into shtick, you know, so that, you know, once he got big and famous, all of a sudden it's like, you know, do that Nicolas Cage shtick that you're so famous for. And, you know, it becomes a parody of itself. And I see the same thing happening here with Johnny Depp. You know, it's like all of a sudden, Pirates of the Caribbean, he is a megastar. We will not see the likes of the Johnny Depp who starred as the undercover FBI agent, again, Donnie Brasco. No.
Right, yeah. No, it's unfortunate, too, because he was fantastic in that. But, again, that was 20 years ago.
Yes. I know, yes.
Yes, and one of the appeals of Johnny Depp in the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie is he was a bit of a hot mess, but he was a hot mess. You know, we the women of Generation X were like, ooh, he's still hot. In the intervening years, we are now done with him.
Yeah.
And any woman my age, we're done with Johnny Depp now, right? Yes, yes. Even before the domestic violence charges, we just said we were done. He was just doing Keith Richards cosplay. And quite frankly, Keith Richards does that better. He's hotter than Johnny Depp.
Oh, wow. Keith Richards is hotter. These conversations actually happen then.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Of course.
Okay. Okay.
Yes.
Johnny Depp, yay or nay?
Nay.
Yeah.
Nay.
I was a little skeptical of him. I mean, I loved the first Pirates film, like everybody, but I was a little skeptical of the Johnny Depp phenomenon from the outset. There was a lot of people coming out of the woodwork as Johnny Depp fans saying they were going to go out and see all of his movies. And I would say, oh, really? Well, let me know what you think of A Nightmare on Elm Street, which, you know, is something that they would not bother with, you know.
Yeah, he's got a lot of different things. I really couldn't imagine someone enjoying all of them.
No. And, especially now, where it is a kind of an embarrassing thing to hear that he's got the fifth Pirates of the Caribbean movie. Even though back when he did the first one, he said, I think, that he would love to play Captain Jack Sparrow forever and ever until he dies. That's how much he loves it. Which I think he reneged on that a little bit when the fourth one came out, saying, yeah, maybe we're done for a while. but of course, now I guess he needs some money.
Isn't that always the case? That's how they got Nicolas Cage, too. So.
He needs some money.
He had to buy that ninth mansion.
I know. Well, Nicolas Cage had to sell all his comic books.
I know.
Which, that sounds like a bad deal.
That's gotta hurt.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. Well, Nicolas Cage, I always say, you know, he peaked with Raising Arizona for me.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I guess Johnny Depp may have peaked with A Nightmare on Elm Street.
I don't know. No, Johnny Depp peaked with Deadwood.
Ed Wood. No, you're right. That's actually it. No, Ed Wood and of course Edward Scissorhands. I haven't cared for him in much of anything. I didn't mind Dark Shadows, but I don't know. I just have no desire at all to go see the fifth Pirates of the Caribbean. I mean, just, I don't care. Here's what I heard, though. Paul McCartney turns up in the movie.
Yes, that's the one reason that I might be roped into watching it at some point. But more likely, I'll just watch Paul McCartney's one little bit on YouTube at some point in a couple months.
Hear, hear. Yes. And yes, that would be good. Keith Richards did turn up, the hot Keith Richards turned up in the third and fourth Pirates of the Caribbean film. This toy company put out like a 20-inch tall action figure of him, which I bought really cheap, and I don't remember how cheap, but I'm hoping that it was really, really cheap, because this thing has been with me ever since, this just giant 2-foot-tall Keith Richards pirate toy. And I'm thinking, should I unload this thing or hold on to it till he, you know... So I don't know, and I'm thinking, hey, maybe they'll make one of Paul McCartney, and then I'll have a reason, you know, I could put these rock star pirate figures together. So if you hear that there's a 2-foot-tall Paul McCartney pirate action figure, let me know.
So and yeah, I just want to know, were they unable to get Ringo? You know, it's like. The guy did Caveman, for crying out loud. You
know, I know.
You're saying that he said no to Pirates of the Caribbean?
What was the last movie that Paul showed up in? Was it Give My Regards to Broad Street? He directed that in 1984, and it stars him.
No, I'm trying to think of any movie where he actually had a role that wasn't like a documentary role where he played himself.
Yeah, but, he doesn't act.
He
so it's not his jam. He's a brilliant songwriter, and that's all he needs to do.
Yeah. When these guys besmirch their legacy, it's always kind of like, no, you don't need to, God, you know? Like when Stan Lee did a reality show on cable a while ago, How to Be a Superhero. Do you remember that?
Yes.
Yes. We got through one episode of that. And then we were like, Stan Lee is dead to us.
I felt the same, and I was like, you so don't need to be doing this, Stan Lee. Your legacy is intact. You're Stan Lee. Don't. And then he, I guess, I don't know how long he did that for.
Yeah, I think that they do this to impress the grandkids. Is my theory, is that the grandkids don't understand their legacy, but they understand that they're in the new Pirates of the Caribbean movie.
Right, yeah. That's probably it.
I was also going to say that the reality show that Stan Lee did, I believe that was before the Marvel movies really started hitting their stride. I think
probably.
It was pre-Iron Man.
Yes, yes.
So, you know, at the time, I'm sure he was panicking. You know, it's like, what do I show the grandkids? Mm-hmm. I'll do this sci-fi thing, you know, starring me. But now he can just say, look at me. I'm playing the mailman.
Yeah. Here's my cameo supercut.
That's right.
You know, 20 Marvel movies. That's always a lot of fun. And I did hear that they shot like his next 4 cameos already.
Yes.
That's right. He's going to be dying soon. So
it's horrible.
That is the thing. Someday you will go see a Marvel movie without a Stanley cameo and a tear will just trickle down your face.
They'll put his photograph on a desk or something every time for a while, at least. And then the world will forget who he was, and we'll all be gone, and nobody will know anything anymore.
That's right.
But they'll still be making Marvel movies.
By that time, they will have gotten down to the inferior 5 and really scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Bring it on, man. I'm enjoying it. I like it. So, let's switch gears. Let's talk about something else. You guys wanted to talk about the new season of the television show Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
That's right.
Take it away.
Okay. Netflix, of course, Booing and Cam, besides the point, has been doing a lot of great series, a lot of good revivals. And Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt was, one of the shows that, was part of the first wave that, when they started producing, some really quality stuff, along with House of Cards and Orange is the New Black. And
in fairness, they've had some duds too. They have had some smashing successes.
Well, there's so much.
Yes.
Yeah, now there is. I mean, it seems like there's a new Netflix series every week. I mean, I don't try to keep up anymore.
Right.
Yeah. No, it's, it is a bit overwhelming that all the new content that you get on Netflix. But Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which of course is Tina Fey and Robert Carlock, who were behind 30 Rock.
Oh, cool. Okay. Yeah, no, I loved 30 Rock, at least what I saw of it. I didn't always get to watch it.
So it has that sensibility with just some of the absurdity and pop culture references.
And the very strong New Yorkness of it.
Yes.
Which is good, huh?
Yes, the gentrification is an overarching theme over the series. They live in a neighborhood that is East Doghead. It's fictional, but it's pretty much, Bushwick of, 10 years ago.
So what season is this of this series? Is it just the second?
Third.
This is the third, yes.
Third season, okay. So they're not moving as quickly as House of Cards.
No.
They got put back because the star,
Ellie Kemper.
Ellie Kemper had a baby.
Oh.
So they took some time off to let her have her baby. So, she's brilliant in it. So
it is just it's a character that how can you prepare for that? It's just unlike anyone else. Are you familiar with the premise?
No, I was just going to ask what that is.
It's a woman who was kidnapped as a teenager and kept with some other women in an underground bunker by
by the Reverend.
By a bad guy, essentially, who held three or four women prisoner and told them that the world had come to an end. They couldn't come out.
Hold on, this is a comedy?
Yes. Oh, and John Hamm plays the Reverend. It's just completely horrible. They kept having to turn the crank. They didn't know what the crank was. They just had to keep turning the crank. Turns out the crank was powering the electric generator in his secret room so he could watch TV while they were all trapped in this little room together.
It sounds like Lost. In the second season of Lost, there was that everyone had to enter the code sequence no matter what, and if you don't, something bad will happen. We don't know what.
Right. And so it begins with they've been rescued, and so she's in her mid-20s but has the sensibilities of a 14-year-old.
And all her pop culture references are, of course, also from the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So she has the sensibility, but, she's the Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt because she survived all that. She's going to show the world what for. She's going to just take on everything, and nothing fears her.
Nothing stops her, but eventually, in the second season especially, the PTSDs did start to come out. And even in the third season, she still has some things that she has to process because it would be too cartoonish if she just went out there and got them all and showed the world. It's obviously a very difficult adjustment, and it's a hilarious one.
Yes.
She got herself a typical lousy New York apartment with a roommate situation with outrageous landlady, outrageous roommates. It's the supporting characters are as strong as she is.
That's funny. When you're saying all of that, how, she has this, I guess, persona, the character in the show has this persona of being the Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. It reminded me of, Gone Girl. Again, not a comedy, but, the character in that, the wife in that film and book, of course, was, had her parents making her into this
character, yeah.
Yeah, this idealized version of herself that she could never live up to, and of course it drove her crazy.
It's Astounding Amy.
Yes.
Yes, yeah. I don't know if that experience is what turned her into the psychopath that she became, but it certainly drove her psychopathy.
It couldn't have helped.
Mm-hmm.
No, it could
spoiler
not
alert,
have
helped. By the way.
Yes.
5-year-old spoiler alert.
Oh, well.
I don't know.
I'm so done with it. full disclosure, I worked on the movie, so there you go.
Great.
That's the
What's Neil Patrick Harris like?
nice.
It's charming.
My job was not being on set very often. I was out running around buying things for the set. So
how many times did they shoot Neil Patrick Harris driving up the driveway and walking into the house?
Oh, at least 25. This is David Fincher. It's what he does. He shoots over and over and over again, and he wants to do that Stanley Kubrick thing, I guess, where you just grind them down until there's like nothing but raw emotion there and desperation, and then that's when you got it.
That's when the magic happens.
I don't know. I was so glad I didn't have to like stay there all day. I was out running around, you know. Jim, we need stanchions. Jim, we need stuff for the refrigerator. We, you know, go, you know. And, yeah, so that kind of thing. So, and I'm just like, you know, it's, I had my own little mini PTSD after, you know, I got done with, you know, then where my cell phone would ring and it'd be like, you know. What do they want?
You need to go to art director rehab.
Yeah. Well, I was working in two cities. We were shooting in Cape Girardeau, but I was living in St. Louis. So, you know, I would buy as much as I could in St. Louis and run it. Sometimes I'd be like, oh, no, what if I'm in the wrong city? So, anyway, I don't want to talk too much about that. Let's talk about now. What else is happening?
But, yes, we were talking about how Netflix got booted Cannes. Speaking
yeah, they did. And again, I'm not. We were talking about this a little bit before the show. I'm not too well versed on this, but Netflix has started to do what Amazon has been doing very successfully in the past few years, which is getting big name film directors and basically giving them their carte blanche to do their thing, but do it for us. Do it for Amazon. Do it, you know, whoever. You know, so Amazon got Woody Allen's, Cafe Society made, which was, I think, if I heard right, was like a $17 million movie or something like that. And, you know, Woody Allen movies tend not to make anywhere near that. But just to have him on the roster was prestige enough for Amazon to throw the money. And, of course, they had the money to throw, so they did. And they've done that with a number of filmmakers. Now, Netflix is doing that with Noah Baumbach, had a film. I think has one or had one at Cannes. Todd Haynes, and the director who made the Korean film The Host. All three of them were given Netflix projects and movies. But the catch is Netflix has no interest in releasing these films theatrically. And us film buffs, you know, are purists enough to say these films belong in a theater. You know, at least initially, and they won't do it.
Well, I guess it's kind of like the debate among writing geeks about the dictionary and the meaning of new words and words changing their meaning. And those gosh darn descriptivists at the dictionary are like, nope, this is how the word is used now. It means that now. I don't care if it was an incorrect usage, no one misunderstood it, that's what it means now. So I kind of think that's a little bit what Netflix is doing, is that this is how we watch TV now.
Right.
And so one would hope that the directors and the cinematographers make it so that it is ideally on a small screen. Maybe not your phone or your iPad, although a lot of people do watch it that way, but...
Well, I think also right now the movie-going experience... You know, Noah Baumbach and, you know, all these other filmmakers wouldn't necessarily be going to Amazon if, you know, there was still a spot for them in the indie world. And, you know, unfortunately, the indie renaissance of the late 90s has sort of gone away. And, you know, it's very hard to get, you know, these lower budgeted, you know, indie movies off the ground anymore. You know, in this environment that you know, rewards Pirates of the Caribbean 5, you know, that, you know, they'll throw $400 million at that rather than making
a $10 million,
yeah, $80-$10 million, $5 million movies or $40-$10 million movies.
And then, of course, another challenge is that Netflix and Amazon are trying to establish themselves as creators of new content. So they want established producers and showrunners. They don't want to give someone a chance because they're trying to prove themselves as it is. So it's all this opportunity, but not for new people.
Yeah.
So it's, you just have the same people making even more shows, and hopefully they are talented and hire more people, just train them up.
And I think that's why the backlash, you know, perhaps is happening at Cannes and elsewhere, by the way. I'm hearing that, you know, that people are starting to regard Netflix as kind of this Walmart of media content, where it's just this giant list of stuff. And yeah, there will be good original films in there, but still, you know, it drops, and after the first weekend, it becomes part of a massive undigestible list of stuff that is just in front of you. You scroll through and, you know, it's really hard to find things. So I know a lot of people are gravitating to the curated platforms like Mubi and Filmstruck and things like that.
I don't know. I'm still too drawn to actually trying to get through my Netflix queue. You know, it's just like the pile of books to be read. It's just something that I will not finish before I die, but I want to get to some
right.
Yeah.
Well, it takes a lot of work to do it right. And I think, you know, people like us are inclined to seek out, you know, the diamonds in the rough as it is. You know, a lot of people that just have Netflix, it's just, you know, 85 bad movies for every one good one, I think is what I heard someone say the ratio might be, you know. And, you know, people don't know anymore what are the new movies or what are the good ones and all that kind of thing. And it does just become this barrage of noise. And like I said, when they booted at Cannes, you know, part of me could relate, even though I have Netflix and I enjoy it, and I'm not going to drop it anytime soon. I even still get DVDs in the mail from them.
Us too, yeah.
Good.
Because the streaming doesn't have everything because of the rights, and what if I want to see something?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I'm a big proponent. It's terrible that I've currently got a massive backlog of Blu-rays and stuff I'm supposed to be reviewing as a film critic. So, you know, film critic problems. And so I haven't watched my Netflix rented disc of the movie Midnight Special. And it's been sitting over there for over 2 months now. And I'm thinking, oh, I should cancel that subscription. And I was like, no. I can't. It, you know, it needs to survive.
We had Before Sunrise waiting for a long time.
Yeah, Before Sunset.
No, isn't the first one Before Sunrise?
First one is Before Sunrise. Second one is Before Sunset. Third one is Before Midnight.
I thought Before Sunset we saw relatively quickly.
No.
Okay.
No, that was the one that we held on for
months. Okay.
Months, yes.
And now Before Midnight is sitting in our living room right now.
Well, you know, good movies.
Yes, but there's a backlog of TV that, you know, that the TiVo is just, you know, visibly bulging. It's so full.
Oh, wow.
And yeah.
It's the thing, you know, I always thought when I die, my biography could be called Backlog, you know, and it could just be this list of things that I have here, books and CDs and movies that I have. That I didn't get to. Comic books, same thing. You know, I used to buy a lot of comic books when I worked in the comic book store, and I haven't done that in many years, and I still have like at least two long boxes unread stuff. You know, just backlog.
Oh,
that's our life. There's too much.
Yeah.
And we're adding to it with stuff like this for people to watch.
Exactly. Yes, I am way behind on the Wonder Show, actually, your guys' podcast, by several years.
I haven't listened to that for years.
Yeah, and I thanks to Netflix, I watched Gilmore Girls four times through in a year and a half, 2 years. So I decided to get the Gilmore Guys podcast, and I'm still seasons behind on that.
And I think I should mention this. I haven't actually heard it myself, so shame on me, but Taylor Blake, who's a reviewer on Zeke Film, she, I think, does a Gilmore Girls podcast called This So It's a Show. And I think what they do there, if I'm not mistaken, and I could be wrong, Taylor can come on here and correct me, that every time they hash out the pop culture references of Gilmore Girls. Mm-hmm.
Because there were many of them. Yeah. And I just added to my list of podcasts I have to listen to.
Yep. Give Taylor's a try. And she'll be on this at some point. She keeps, you know, she's one of our contributors who's interested in being on Zeke Talk. So, yeah. Check this out. There's a magic wand.
Ooh.
I just found it on my desk. My father-in-law made this for somebody's birthday cake. It was a Harry Potter thing. So.
Very cool. And as long as we're doing show and tell, on my desk here, I've got an R2-D2 Bendy Straw.
Oh, cool.
Well, here. Straw from when? Probably from the prequel years.
The prequel years? Yeah. The when they had all this stuff in fast food. Last week when we did the Star Wars episode, my kids were like, why didn't you get down the Han Solo blaster? It's right there. I mean, it's literally right up on the shelf. And I didn't. So here, this is last week. This is my Han Solo blaster.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Okay.
All right.
You move your head in the background. There is a Millennium Falcon in the box.
I see that. What's your story there?
It's a repro. It's not from the 70s, but I have a younger brother, and what parent is going to buy two of everything? So he got all of the action figures and toys, and I got the Princess Leia and Lando Calrissian action figures that he didn't want, and that was it. So I was very jealous. So in the 90s, I guess at some point, and you know what, I have my own income. I bought myself a Millennium Falcon, but it is still in the box because it takes up a lot of room, and one of these days we'll probably have it hanging from a ceiling or.
There you go.
But yeah, so you take the top out and put the action figures. It's very fun.
Yes.
Yeah, those 90s versions was actually the same molds as the 70s versions, if I remember right. For the vehicles, the Land Speeder and the X-Wing Fighter, they brought those back. They got the same molds out of mothballs at Kenner and remade them, except if you take one from the 70s and the version from the 90s and put them next to each other, you'll notice the 90s version is slightly smaller in every way. Because the molds actually somehow molecularly shrunk. Yeah.
Interesting.
Because of science.
The Mythbusters would know.
Yes.
That's right. So,
plus, they've got new stickers. So,
new
so
stickers.
Make it look a little bit more battle-worn.
Yeah, that was always the question. Are you going to leave it nice and pretty, or are you going to make it look messy by putting on the battle scars?
Well, you have to
ruining it or not.
You have to make it look like the movie. That's all it is. So, before we go, last minute items here. I'm just going to promote the stuff I'm going to be working on here. I'm going to review this movie. I'm not sure what this is. This is 8-Bit Generation: The Commodore Wars, and it's a documentary that is on DVD now. And I have yet to. Obviously, you can tell I haven't looked at this yet. I'm going to be looking at it soon. Hopefully that's good. I'll have a review up. Do you guys know anything about the Commodore Wars?
The documentary or about the actual wars?
The actual wars. What was the casualty rate there?
Casualty rate, it was, I think, 128K.
Well, I just got this because, you know, it's 8-bit generation, and I know enough about this sort of thing, which is very little. You know, my boys are into Minecraft, which is one of these games that looks like everything's, you know, blocks, you know, high bit rate. And so it's like, okay, maybe it'll get into that. You know, talk about this resurgence of the old blocky video game aesthetic.
Well, the thing is, you know, I can see, you know, what the Commodore Wars might have entailed, because in the 80s, it was like, you know, everyone had their own system. Really? You had the Commodore, the TRS-80s, you had PCs, you had, you know, Apple Macs, you know, the first generation Macintoshes, you had the Apple IIes, you know, it was a plethora of systems out there. And unlike now, where it's basically you're a Mac or you're a PC. You know, it's like you couldn't have those commercials back in the 80s. It'd be like, you know, I'm a Mac, I'm a PC, you know, I'm a TRS-80, I'm a TI-94A.
It would just go on.
You know, I'm an Amiga.
Ah, it's the whole 30 seconds is just I'm this, I'm that, and nothing gets advertised.
Yeah, nothing gets advertised. But yes, yeah. You know, it was everyone trying to crawl their way to the top of the bunch because, you know, everything hadn't quite, you know, panned out just yet. It's like, I mean, the Atari STs, I think, were the first ones that actually had more than 256 colors. You know, that was a big thing back in the day. It was like, you can look and it looks like a photograph. You know, colors.
Amazing.
That, and then, you know, all of a sudden the Amiga came, and oh, boy, you can do computer graphics. Look. You know, it was just, it was like every new computer system had its own, you know, its own, its own revolution, its computing revolution. Mm-hmm. You know, that is something that, you know, only it could do. And then finally everything sort of panned out and, you know, it's like, okay, you got Mac and you got PC. And you can,
right.
You can kind of do the same sort of stuff. But
I'm Mac. That's all I can handle. You know.
I'm a Mac, he's a PC.
I have to go back and forth, so.
And this is okay in a marriage.
Oh yes.
He's Star Trek, I'm Star Wars, he's Doctor Who, I'm Blake Seven. It's a mixed marriage, we can make it work.
Huh. Wow, interesting.
Also sometimes I need to borrow a PC, so that works out well.
Yeah, I'm also Star Wars and Mac, so I don't know how it is. I've been friends with Mike all these years.
Yes.
It's that tension that makes you
cry. That's right.
That's right. If we were both Star Wars and Mac, then what would we
talk then
about? It'd be like, oh, yeah, that Han Solo is cool.
Yep.
You'd be talking about Kip Doran all night long.
And just because I self-identify as Star Trek rather than Star Wars.
Right.
It doesn't mean that I haven't, put up a really good fight at the Star Wars Trivial Pursuit.
I understand that, but you don't know who Kip Doran is, so.
Wow. I'm not sure I know that. So, yeah, as I think Mayor Quimby said, there can be two things.
That's right, there can be two things.
So, all right, well, I will say I've got... How to succeed in business without really trying? I've never seen this. I have to watch this.
Yes.
You like it?
It looks like a new production.
No.
Is that the original movie?
Yes, Robert. Yeah, your thumb is Robert, covering his name, but
Robert
yes.
Morris. Sorry, it's 1967. Is there a glare or anything?
Yes. Yeah, Robert Morris. Yes. Oh, that's a wonderful movie.
Okay, great. I'm glad because it's 121 minutes, and I gotta watch it. And then Hitchcock's Paradine Case, which is one of these forgotten Selznick affairs. I may have showed that a few weeks ago. I still have to watch it.
And here's my thing.
Okay.
Bob Burgers, the soundtrack, just came today, thanks to Amazon.
What is
it's
that?
A music album. It's four discs of music.
Of what kind?
Beautiful, beautiful package.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Is that vinyl? That's amazing.
Yes, it's all the music from the first six seasons of Bob's Burgers.
By whom?
By the cast.
Oh, wow.
They have a song in every episode.
There's a song in every episode. And some of the episodes are more musical. That, like, last season or the season before that, they had to put on school production where half the class wanted to do Die Hard and the other half wanted to do Working Girl, and they ended up buying them too. So it's...
Is it 1988?
Working Girl or Die Hard?
Is it 1988 in the show?
No.
Because their choices are...
They're classics.
They're classics.
And I just saw Working Girl for a Zeke film piece a few years ago, or last year, I think. I saw it for the first time. It was one of those great discoveries that, my own website has prompted me to discover. So I would say Working Girl, you know, although Die Hard might be the best action movie ever made. I don't know how you act that out.
So. Very carefully.
What did they pick?
No, they combined the two.
Oh, I missed that detail.
They did a mashup.
Yes.
Oh, of course.
Get working or die hard, girl.
That's not that funny, but I...
And yet okay. It is.
Yeah. Okay. Well, fantastic. Jen, what do you got? You working on anything?
I'm rewatching the Prison Break finale.
What?
I was absolutely obsessed with the revival. And it's such a guy's show, but I started watching it last fall because after watching Gilmore Girls 4 times, I needed something different. So of course, Prison Break is the obvious choice. And I was just on the edge of my seat for this entire series. I felt like such an idiot. I'm actually gasping out loud at some parts of the revival. And it's very good. It's very satisfying.
So it captures that old Prison Break magic.
Yes. Some of the critics, Entertainment Weekly, whatever, say it's not on a par with the first season. The first season was absolutely brilliant. But no, it's solid. It's very good.
The first season is when they were in prison, right? I never watched it, but everybody
yes.
loved that. And then they got out. And what happened was I was working on a film production here in St. Louis with a bunch of guys from Chicago. Mm-hmm. And what they'd been doing that whole year was working on Prison Break. And they said it was the best gig in the world because, you know, as far as filmmaking goes, you show up to the prison where mm-hmm. they're filming this and, you know, you move a few things around or whatever, it's not a whole lot of set dressing really. And that was the department, you know, cause it's the prison, that's it. And, you know, maybe a few other things here and there, but you know, you show up there to work, you work your hours, you go home and it's right there in town. It was in Chicago. And then in the show, the guys got out and of course they moved the whole show to the East Coast and they completely lost the gig.
Well, they actually relocated to Dallas. One of the department heads actually lived in Dallas.
Oh.
And within the radius, like 100-mile radius or 50-mile radius of Dallas, they were actually able to find areas that looked like all over the country because they were on the run. And the first season was just a very tight puzzle box of, all right, all the different, this overly elaborate plan and all the tattoos all fit in and, well, what's he going to do next? And then they get out and because he's brought extra people with him, his plan for after they escape is completely falling apart. And so it's still pretty good. You know, they have to get out of the country and things don't go well. And then they actually do make it. And then the third season, I think they shot it in Florida or possibly still in Dallas. I'm not sure. They were supposed to be in Panama for that.
Breaking up another prison. That's the vacation.
Yeah. Then the fourth season, it was more like an Ocean's 11 heist thing where they had to, you know, take down the government conspiracy. And then this one, they had to break one of the guys out of Yemen. A prison in Yemen who had faked his death, and turns out he's not dead, and he's been recruited by CIA because he's so good at breaking out of prisons.
So it's a revival, not a redo. This is the same.
Right. It's a continuation. It was like the first 3 episodes was getting out of the prison, the second 3 episodes was getting out of Yemen, the third 3 were back in the country taking down the vast government conspiracy.
Okay, so that's
this is actually more of a small government conspiracy, which is why they could do it in 9 episodes total.
Let's hear about your blog. Anything there? Anything to plug? Anything at all?
Not at the moment.
Any gigs?
Yeah, my blog is just collecting dust at the moment.
I understand.
Follow me on Twitter. I'm hilarious on Twitter. Jen Anderson NYC.
One more time. I think I talked over you.
At Jen Anderson NYC. It's me on Twitter. That's usually where I do anything that I would have blogged before.
Okay, great. And you know and understand Twitter and tried to coach me on it when I got on last year. I am Jim Tudor Film on Twitter. And is it at Jim? I don't even know.
Yes,
I'm still awful at this. And Mike, are you on that?
I am on Twitter, yes. I'm awful at it as well. But
And that is a sticking point in our marriage.
Yeah, that's right.
That he will not listen to me and take my advice and go on.
He's Facebook, you're Twitter.
He's not even Facebook that much.
This is where we're solidarity then. Mike, I'm a Facebook. I can only handle one of these things.
Well, I am at AutoBeatnik. That's AutoBeatnik.
And hopefully you two will start live tweeting shows or live tweeting movies. You can just live tweet something that is not on live. That people just live tweet their Buffy rewatch. Okay. And that actually will get you followers. People will really enjoy that. I once live tweeted the Star Wars Holiday Special. where a bunch of people actually got together. Someone found one particular recording on YouTube, and we all started at the same time and just live tweeted it together.
That's to do anything with the Star Wars Holiday Special, that takes some doing. So
yes. That reminds me, have you seen the Star Wars Nothing But Star Wars Master Mix?
No. What is
have
that?
Have you heard of such a thing?
No.
Go to YouTube. It's the Star Wars Nothing But Star Wars mixtape.
Okay.
Do it when you have 90 minutes to spare.
Yes, it's 90 minutes of Star Wars miscellany all edited together, including bits of the Star Wars Holiday Special, but also like the Donnie and Marie Star Wars sketch, a couple snippets from Star Wars porn movies of the 70s, different variety shows, interview shows, local news shows. It's just all a mixed match, and including a ballet done to disco Star Wars music done on a French television series in the 70s.
The 70s were a very strange time.
It was a very strange time, and yes, it's bizarre. They found a lot of stuff that even I had never seen, and so it's mesmerizing.
I will take your word for it until such a time.
Okay.
That sounds like something.
And yes.
I thank you for this tip, Mike and Jen. I thank you for coming here on Zeke Talk, which we're on YouTube also, by the way. With any luck, we'll be smashed right against, right up there against the Star Wars Nothing But Star Wars feed. And, people can hop on over.
That's right. After this is over, do a search for that. Find it. Watch it. Thank me later.
Watch it. Watch it in 10-minute increments.
Will do. Okay, guys. Well, let's wrap it up. And we'll do another show next week.
Okay. Wrap it up.
Where it could be some Wonder Woman talk.
Wonder Woman.
And her seven knights fighting for your rights.
That's my favorite line.
It's everyone's favorite line.
Yeah. Okay, well, have a great week, you two. And don't watch too many Doctor Who episodes there.
No, we'll try not to. Yeah. No promises.
That's
though.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Thanks, everybody, and don't forget to visit the ZekeFilm.org and check out all our new stuff and subscribe to Zeke Talk. And we'll see you later.